And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I love saying that because it's live on American Freedom Radio for the listening discomfort of those people who are just going, you know, my worldview is more important than the truth. I need to defend it aggressively against anybody who tries to question my perception of reality that I created for myself through various years of brainwashing. Okay, this is what the show is about. It's for you people to not listen to. My very special guest who's with us today is an author, David Livingstone. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
When did you get your first book on the road, mate?
2001 is the first book I published.
You might want to lean a little closer to your microphone there.
Okay, I'll do that.
And also close any web programs you've got going other than the Skype, of course. Now, I found that 9/11 really woke a lot of people up to conspiracy, because it was one of those sort of, it was so in your face that it shocked a lot of people. And sometimes when you get traumatized, you go past denial and you wind up accepting that there's some kind of hidden hand or hidden meaning. And I think that event around that 2001, around the invasion of Iraq period, was where I would say the new birth of the truth movement kind of thing came from, around the time that Loose Change Final Cut was starting to be introduced. Out of that trauma, out of that shock, came the inspiration to awaken people.
I hope so.
Now, in terms of writing and all of that kind of thing, would you be able to give us a bit of background on yourself and a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Sure. The story I usually tell is that I started, I went to an experimental college in Montreal. It was part of the University of Concordia in Montreal. It is called the Liberal Arts College. It's a college which is separate from university, but appended to the university. And it was a unique opportunity. What they did is they tried to revive what used to be called the Great Books programs. And so it was an attempt to recreate sort of a lost method of education. And what was exceptional about it? Because the problem with universities is that you basically get a choice of electives. And even if you pick a particular subject, your courses can be all over the place. And most people still somehow pick up the basic idea of Western civilization. But this was a program that was specifically designed to teach the history of Western civilization. And it was a three-year program with three courses per year that were timed simultaneously. So you progress simultaneously the first year from the Bible to French Revolution, second year French Revolution, 20th century, and the third year 20th century. And these three courses were independent but progressed together. So what I'm grateful for is that what I got was the version of the history of Western civilization as it was originally developed and originally taught. And so what I found after, in fact, only a few years ago, was that the course, the whole college is basically replete with Illuminati symbolism. So the logo of the college is the Owl of Minerva, and the Owl of Minerva, of course, is the symbol of the Illuminati. And I think they, if I remember correctly, they even used, because basically the history of Western civilization as it's been taught is Hegel's philosophy of history. And so there's been a lot of rumors that Hegel was a member of the Illuminati, but there is no real true concrete true evidence. But the one sort of vague reference is when he refers to the Owl of Minerva in one of his books. So, I mean, there's more to that. Basically, the book that they used, the main history book that they used by William H. McNeil, who was a professor of history from University of Chicago, and his mentor was John Maynard Hutchins. John Maynard Hutchins is the man who was responsible for inviting Leo Strauss to University of Chicago. And University of Chicago, if anybody's interested in this history, there's a great scholarly article about the development of what's called the Western Civilizations Course. This is a history I talk about in my books. There is also, what's his name? Is it William Dodd, who wrote the Tax Exempt Foundations? He's really the one who was one of the first originally responsible for identifying the role of American charitable foundations, particularly the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations, in development or the manipulation of the American educational system. Another great book is Universities and the Capitalist State by Clyde Barrow, which also details exactly how this entire process of how the university system was basically hijacked by two charitable foundations, and then how they developed the basically myth of the history of Western civilization to act as a form of propaganda to steer the United States in particular for their for the political aims. So to make a long story short, what I found is that, you know, the Western Civilization Course, as I mentioned, there's an article, a scholarly article by, I can't remember his first name, his last name is Allardyce, which I think is called The Rise and Fall of the Western Civilization Course. So it originally became very popular after World War I and was widely adopted across the United States, but then through the influence of the counterculture in the 60s, it sort of its influence died out. So my college happened to be an attempt to try to revive the
We appear to have lost David. That's extremely unfortunate. David, are you still there? Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's quite difficult, isn't it? Yeah. Live radio. It's one of these things that happens. So I do apologize for those of you who are actually listening to this live, because I wanted to take this opportunity just to remind you that you are listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and this is a listener-supported network as well as a listener-supported show. If you do like the variants of the different hosts on the network, go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and donate. And if you like the variants of the different guests that we have here on The Vinnie Eastwood Show, go to TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate. And we also really do suggest that you do your monthly donation as well. David, welcome back. I've just been doing a bit of a qualifier on this because a listener sent me a message and she said, you know, halfway through the show is Vinny, I'll tune in and there'll be people talking or you'll be talking, it'll be really interesting, but when I go back, I have no idea what the hell their name is or whatever. So, you know, just mention the person's name for those of you who are just joining us on occasion. And I thought, you know, that's actually an interesting approach, isn't it? But anyway, welcome back. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, as you were.
Yes, I was saying that the college I went to, the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University, I found it was replete with Illuminati symbolism. This is not what I knew at the time. I didn't discover that till recently. I was at the college from, I think, 89 to 91, somewhere around there. And so, as I was mentioning, what was great about it is that it was a full-blown introduction to the myth of Western civilization. So at the time, especially reading William H. McNeil's History of Western Civilization, there were a number of references in there that I found were odd. Particularly, the claim is that between, I think, around 2000 to 500 BC, the way it's described is that there's wave upon wave of Indo-European invaders escaped the Caucasus and conquered the known parts of the world. So that struck me as very strange. If you look at the rise and fall of most ancient civilizations, they rise pretty slowly. Like you look at Egyptian civilization or Mesopotamian civilization, basically they're nomads who settle down, they start agriculture, and then people slowly accumulate and they develop cities. So I never heard of a case of a people coming out of nowhere and destroying and invading and taking over other cultures. So this sounded kind of strange. So I decided to take a closer look to see what was the origin of this idea. And that's when I found that Indo-European is actually basically just a modern, politically correct way of saying Aryan. And if you look at the origin of the theory of the Aryan race, it's actually an occult idea which has no historical basis. So really, when you look at who originated these ideas originally in the late 1700s, were scholars who were trying to prove in their way the existence, because according to Kabbalistic legend, there's so many places to start. So basically, Freemasonry of the Western occult tradition is supposedly based on the survival of a single occult tradition, which dates back, it goes under many different names, but its common origin is the Jewish Kabbalah. And so the Jewish Kabbalah, according to legend, was originally taught by these what are called in the Bible the sons of God. And the sons of God, supposedly, who are equated with the fallen angels, I should add, came down to earth in the time before the flood. So occultists equated that with the legend of Atlantis that was mentioned by Plato. So the myth is that these sons of God interbred with human beings, or the daughters of Cain, as they're mentioned in the Bible, and produced a race of semi-divine beings. And so these, to whom they taught the what's called ancient wisdom, or the magic of the Kabbalah. So, and supposedly this semi-divine race have been responsible since that time for preserving this quote-unquote ancient wisdom. So what these scholars of the late 17th century, what they were doing is they were trying to attempt to give what they thought was scientific validation to the idea that there was this race, original race, which had conquered principally Asia, Persia, and then Europe, and then spread their knowledge of the ancient wisdom. So this is an idea that has, like as I said, it's basically, it's an occult idea. It has no scientific basis, but it became accepted as mainstream history and is still basically unchallenged today, and which is why it was in William H. McNeil's version of history. So basically that was the quest. When I realized that here was an idea that had an occult origin, which found its way into a mainstream history book, into the mainstream version of Western civilization, then that's when I decided to start looking further. So when I looked for the root of where would these ideas have originated, that's where I found Freemasonry. And then when I found Freemasonry, there's all kinds of legends that surround it. But what I wanted to know was where specifically it came from, like past the legend, past the mythology, how could I identify the true origin of these ideas? And they go back far in time. A lot of the people that are mentioned in this history, their stories have been embellished, but still they did have an important influence. So particularly people like Pythagoras and Plato. So I just kept going back and back and back and back and back until I finally recognized that the Kabbalah originated in the 6th century BC in Babylon. And it was known in ancient times as the as the arts of the Chaldean Magi. And what happens at that point is that because the world was basically ignorant of the existence of the Jews and their religion, that these, well, then first of all, these were heretical Jews. So there was the traditional Orthodox Jewish tradition, which survived, but there was also this Kabbalistic heretical tradition, which emerged. So the practitioners were not identified by the ancient world as Jewish or Jewish heretics. They were known as Chaldean Magi. And so with the conquest of Babylon by Cyrus in, I think, 538 BC, what happens is that these Chaldean Magi, the Magi start to spread to various parts of the world. And the most important places where they spread were Egypt and then in Greece. So in Greece, they were responsible for the birth of what's called Greek philosophy. So, you know, Greek philosophy is presented, I mean, this is part of the myth of Western civilizations, that they present Greek philosophy as being the birth of the Western tradition and also the first, basically, rejection of religious ideas, when in fact it was the adoption of Near Eastern occult ideas, specifically the ideas of the Magi. So what happens out of this is that you have two traditions. You have the Greek philosophical tradition, which represents one branch, and then you have this other branch in Egypt, which eventually came to be known as Hermeticism. So later, when
Alexander, the Egyptians and the Greeks and all of that kind of stuff stored all the history in the Library of Alexandria, and then somebody burned it down.
Yes, they did.
Have you noticed that it's quite difficult to figure out what happened in ancient history when people burn the primary documents? It's just unbelievable, man. And what was another realization that I had before? We're talking about the sons of God and coming down, right? And they're digging up skeletons that are like 20 feet tall. Now, I'm no grand historian, but I do know that traditionally in human culture, the biggest guy tended to be in charge because he could club all the other smaller guys and get all the women for himself. Who do you think was rolling the earth when there were 20-foot motherfuckers walking around? You see? We used to be controlled by some big bunch of giants and stuff like that. That's what I reckon. That's what we can piece together from all the stuff that hasn't been destroyed as yet. You know, there's still some plenty of monuments and everything in Iraq that haven't been blown up by ISIS yet, who are funded by the US, who are in turn controlled by occultists, who want to erase history. Did anybody see the pattern emerging here? All right. What appears to be very simple for somebody who's, you know, slightly smarter than the average will appear confounding and absolutely ridiculous and crazy to somebody who's of average intelligence. I've noticed, like, the split is that sharp, isn't it? You can't see the connections between history. You can't see the occult references. You can't see the ancient beliefs that have been trickled down and filtered and repackaged and sold as modern culture today, isn't it? We're living in the occultist paradise.
It's now referred to as a New Age movement.
The solipsistic, my perception controls reality.
Yeah.
One note on that. I asked somebody about this one time. Your perception controls reality. That's right. And they go, how come I disagree with you, first of all? And and secondly, what about the other 7 billion consciousnesses of the other people around here? You think your lone perception annexes them all out? You know?
No answer.
Perhaps a little flaw in the design. I'm not pushing it too hard, am I? Well, you know, the things that you'll believe if you don't think.
No.
But I digress. please go back and expand on the history and the occult and whatnot.
Right. So there were two branches: the Egyptian branch, which was all Hermeticism. What happened when the Romans conquered Egypt? Alexandria became the cultural hub of the what's called the Hellenistic world, and so these various traditions began to meet. And so you have the Jewish heretical tradition merging back with Hermeticism and Greek philosophy, which had then evolved into what's called what's referred to as Neoplatonism. And
Hermetic heretics. So, Hermetic heretics.
Well, I mean, the Kabbalah is a Jewish heresy. It's a Luciferian reversal of the Bible teachings. So what happens that Alexandria then becomes a crucible of the Western esoteric tradition. So when these various cults merge together and cross-pollinate, that's basically where the Western tradition begins, is that from there it moves forward. So out of that, you get you also get the influence of the ancient mysteries, most importantly, the worship of Mithras, which is really a combination of all those influences. And then with the collapse of the Roman Empire, these same traditions get absorbed into the Islamic world, where they produce Sufism, but most importantly, a cult known as the Ismailis. The Ismailis supposedly got in contact with the Templars, to whom they taught the ancient mysteries. The Templars evolve into the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians basically evolve. Well, you know, I used to say Illuminati, but I don't think the Illuminati were the true occult order. The Martinists, I believe, were the most important. And then finally into Freemasonry. So to bring this full circle, when you look at the Islamic organizations, the Islamic terrorist organizations in our time, they were created.
And just to remind people, you're listening to American Freedom Radio, and we are with David Livingstone from Empire New Media. He's dropped out again, so that's quite the difficulty there. So I want to remind people again to donate to American Freedom Radio and the Vinnie Eastwood Show, if you all please and want to do so. This is another interesting topic on this, isn't it? How in the modern world, because we're able to share so much information, even though so much information is controlled as misinformation or disinformation, etc., we're still able to accumulate so much in the aggregate that we can piece together times that are long past and bring a little bit of understanding to them in our time. And David now joins us back again. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
All right, continue.
Yeah, so the modern terrorist groups, particularly most of the, like ISIS, of course, most of the modern terrorist groups, ISIS, the Muslim Brotherhood, they all trace themselves to a tradition which is called Salafism. And Salafism really emerges in the late 19th century and was developed by Muslim Freemasons. That's an oxymoron, but they were Freemasons posing as Muslims. And so what they supposedly represented was the survival of, I mean, this was really the mythology that was at play behind the scenes. They supposedly represented the survival of the Ismaili tradition that went back to the assassins, that was now recombining, you know, almost 1,000 years later with their cousins, the Freemasons.
Hmm. That's about the story of the Hashishin, is it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I want to tell that story, actually, for those of you who don't know the origin of the word assassin and hashish are one and the same, the Hashishin. Now, legend tells that there was some kind of warlord, and his followers were incredibly dedicated to him. The reason they were so dedicated is because they thought he could take them to heaven. And the reason they thought he could take them to heaven is when he would invite them round to his palace to recruit them, he would feed them a hell of a lot of laced hashish food, and they would trip fucking balls. And then he led them into his garden, and he would have naked women bring out trays of pork. All right, because in the Muslim tradition, that's kind of forbidden, right? Until you get to the afterlife. So he convinced them while they were tripping balls that they had visited heaven and that he could do that for them and then bring them back safely. Such was their resolve that he would actually test them to jump off battlements, and they would be smiling all the way down to their death. Local warlords didn't like someone having followers with this kind of power and dedication, so they amassed a great war band to try and destroy his fortifications. And as they were camped outside, the Lord came out and said, "Look, all your generals, just go home, son, okay? If you don't, you'll all be dead by morning." And they're like, "Ah, I've got 50 men in my personal retinue. 14 of them are my cousins. I've known all of them for nearly 20 years. You can't freaking touch me." And they woke up, and the general woke up the next morning, and there were 9 daggers sticking into his pillow. And so he organized his war band to hastily fuck off. And the Hashishin have sort of ruled under the cover of night ever since, haven't they?
Yeah, so, yeah, and their modern representative is the Aga Khan.
The modern representative is the what?
Aga Khan.
The Aga Khan? He sounds like a Khan.
Well, the Aga Khan, you know, which one? I guess the grandfather of the current Aga Khan. He was one of the first Secretary Generals of the League of Nations.
Oh, well, there you go. It's a very small world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially if it's controlled by the same families over the, you know, past 100 or, in fact, probably several thousand years of the bloodlines all traced back, isn't it?
Seems like, yeah.
Go to the same meetings and part of the same clubs. There's a whole bunch of this. It's to do with Freemasonry, but it's not to do with Freemasonry. Because when I look at a lot of the Masons that I know, they're not the political Masons. They're more like the historical Masons or the mathematical Masons or the geometric shape Masons or something like that. Or the porch Masons who are just there to, you know, get away from their wives. And unfortunately, though, it's the ones who ascend to the much higher echelons and seek power and public office are the ones that you've actually got to worry about. And the vast majority of Freemasons don't do that. So it provides a perfect cover for the entire organization as a whole. You have 1 million members worldwide, about 999,000 of them ain't really doing that much bad in the world, but there's a bunch of very, very well-connected, extremely powerful ones within that structure that are using the covet of secrecy that every member has to abide by to keep their crimes from being aired, to keep their plans from being exposed.
Yeah. Well, I think that it also serves as a networking mechanism, obviously, as a way of communicating not so much directives, but certainly ideology. It's a way of knowing who's who, right? So I think depending on what part of the hierarchy you step into, you can quickly find out who's above you, who's beside you, what the chain of command is. Because from what I've seen, you know, It's very easy to trace involvement in secret societies up until pretty much until the Golden Dawn, and after that, you know, there's record of Masons in who belong to Freemasonry, but there's not the same record of involvement in secret societies. There's the OTO, which is very influential, But the people who are involved in that are mainly countercultural figures. So people like William S. Burroughs and Timothy Leary, people like that. But it's harder to trace the involvement of other people. Like a person who comes to the top of mind is Aldous Huxley. I found very little information to connect him to Freemasonry. And people like Willis Harmon is very important, president of SRI, one of the leaders of the CIA's remote viewing program. Other people like, especially all the people involved in the New Age movement, Robert Anton Wilson is a very important case. So, but what I find constantly repeated is references at different key points to Freemasonry. So even though, I mean, obviously it's a secret organization, so it's pretty hard to trace. But, and sometimes I wonder what's the degree of its involvement in the conspiracy. But the conspirators make certain key hints every once in a while. So when you look at how they're all interconnected, something's got to bind them. And they all follow the same teaching. So something's got to be there to basically bring them in and let them know, you know, what the agenda is at particular points in time. So I don't know how it works because, you know, we don't have any books available to say, okay, you know, here's their books and here's what they're teaching each other. Yeah.
Now we do. James Robert Wright came out of the Scottish Rite, I think it was, a 32nd degree member, and wrote the Filthy Rituals of Freemason, about ritual abuse and anti-gay stuff. So he's actually written out the rituals and the whole thing now. So he's endured a lot of stalking and pretty terrible consequences. He can't really live in one place for too long. They find him, and it's kind of like, you ever seen one of those horror movies where they say that it doesn't matter if you leave the house, the demon will come with you because it's not attached to the house, it's attached to you? It's like that. Like, I've spoken to him privately, and the phone ringing off the hook again and again and again for like a straight 24 hours, like unbelievable the manpower that it takes to actually stalk someone to that degree. And that's part of the reason why so few people really come out with a whole bunch of documents and things like that, because of the consequences of doing such a thing.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's amazing how well they've managed to keep so much secret for so long. It's how few whistleblowers have come out of an organization with so many members and so powerful for so long. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's him and James Wright and Frederick's as well, who has a show on this network. I'd probably say they're the two leading whistleblowers in the world today at this point. And it's coming down to, like, I've never seen the occult orders actually be exposed to this degree before. To have it become such a commonplace discussion, I mean, far from commonplace, of course, at the moment. Yeah.
But yeah, just go around the corner.
But becoming very slowly more so. It's become noticeable, the growth of this discussion. And the importance of this discussion is much like finding out who your real parents are, or finding out what your kind of potential is, right? Because that's what occult knowledge is. It's simply a secret. Why do they keep it a secret? It's because knowledge is power only if you're the only one who possesses it and uses it against other people.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that.
That's about accumulating power for yourself, right? Whereas my perspective
they have to keep it secret because they know we'd be disgusted if we knew what they were up to. So is the way they rationalize it is the excuse that, well, we're we're too feeble minded to we can't handle the truth.
Yeah, and it's just a big lie, isn't it? Of course we can.
Yeah, because really, magic is a pretty gruesome, very disgusting kind of practice, and it's not really just about manipulating secret powers of nature. There's some pretty awful stuff.
Ritual, so, satanic abuse, and things of this nature.
Child abuse, and
Okay, let me just give an example of that to the audience, because I've actually had to talk to people who've had these kind of things happen to them, right? When your child being raped repeatedly, having been lowered into a coffin in a grave, right? And having your father dress in a robe with a big book that says your name is not in the book of life, scary, dark, horrific shit. And we're talking about discussing hours upon hours of it with so many different people, talking about these child abuse cults that are run by a group of Freemasons that are called the Jesters in the District of Columbia. You know what a jester's job is? To entertain the court. And they have a chain of hospitals with burn victim children and things of that nature who get carted off and get these wonderful little holidays with a whole bunch of old men on boats out in the Bahamas and stuff like that. Sick stuff. The kind of thing I believe one person who I interviewed actually, she personified exactly what I was fearing would happen to me just by investigating this stuff. She had to go and see a trauma counselor because she was hearing about people who had gone through traumatic stuff and investigating this. It hadn't happened to her. But because she now knew that this was real, that this stuff didn't just happen in the movies and stuff like that, that it was absolutely real, coming to that realization comes as a shock to the system, that there are things that go bump in the night.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the jesters, because that's something I've been trying to investigate, the Royal Order of Jesters.
What I've been following recently is
the history of Discordianism. So I've been trying to see if there's a connection.
Well, there might be. I don't know. I'm not the expert. I simply just talk to them. Now, ladies and gentlemen, bear in mind you are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. This is a listener-supported broadcast, so please go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate today. Make sure you give us a couple of dollars a month. There's also a $2.50 a week option, so that averages out at about $10 a month for those of you who won't have 10 bucks at the end of the month, but you probably got $2.50 at the end of the week. Are you broke as everybody else is? Because there's a new world order that's hijacked the base accountancy of credit and the issuance of your currency like that too? Do you know anybody in the mainstream media who's exposing that shit and trying to free you from it? Didn't think so. So give your false, evil, Masonic symbol currency to the Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. $2.50 a week is not too much to ask for. And my very special guest now returning is David Livingston. This is actually getting quite good. It's punctuating, and I'm getting to promo the station and ask for donations every time you drop out. And now you come back and come. Well, I'm having fun. Okay. And yes, the occult. Hey, just because we're being ruled by demons doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point? Okay. Calm down. I've been in a bit of a giggly mood today.
Yeah.
As you can tell, because I watched the Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck movie Giggly as well. I'm just joking. No, nobody watched. Nobody watched that movie, bro. Okay. I'm going to attempt some level of professionalism. Right? Real professionalism. Okay, watch. I fucked it up. I can't help it. Okay. Sorry, David. Please. Continue.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to go down this tangent, but basically my latest book is on transhumanism. And what I found is one of the most important trends of modern times is the Discordianism. And it seems to be closely related. I haven't found a direct connection with the Royal Order of Jesters, but it seems that this whole pranksterism seems to be the new approach to occultism. In fact, I don't know if this is connected, but I wrote an article about Ann Coulter, because there's a couple of journalists who are now suspecting that she's basically a performance artist. She even refers to herself as...
I'm unfamiliar with Ann Coulter, sorry.
Ann Coulter is basically what's referred to as a far-right pundit in the United States. She's written, I think, 11 bestsellers. And she just comes out. She's sort of your very, actually, overly stereotypical right-wing American. Everything is the liberals this, the liberals that. And she just comes out and says, like, the most absurd things. She doesn't hold back at all in how far she's willing to take her criticisms and commentary. And it's almost too far. So there's been a couple of, there's an article in Salon.com that suggests that she's actually, it's a stunt. And she's basically some kind of performance artist. And so that tactic is basically the same as what I've seen as being one of the most important modern trends in occultism. And situationism is a very important example. In fact, it probably really dates back to situationism. Have you heard of situationism?
No.
So situation.
The situation never, where I came across it, never happened.
Yeah, so situationism is basically, it's a philosophy that was articulated by a guy named, a French thinker, activist, by the name of Guy Debord. And so he started what's called the Situation International. This is a movement. This is what I'll also trace in my book is the influence of the avant-garde. The avant-garde emerges out of the occult, and the avant-garde has had a very important influence throughout the 20th century. So the situation and base is
what do they do? Do they just guard the avant? Do they?
As best they can, yeah.
What do you do? I am the avant-garde.
So they, so situationism basically is, you know, the first real important avant-garde movement would be the Dada movement. And then you have a succession of movements after that, and situationism is one of those movements. So what they do is they believe in, effectively they believe in creating situations. And situations, kind of like a performance art, basically, that are designed to challenge people, to challenge how they think, to get them to rethink things that they've taken for granted. So one of the most famous situationist stunts in modern times would be the Sex Pistols. So the Sex Pistols were created by Malcolm McLaren with no intention of creating music. It was purely a political stunt. And as from his situationist influences. So the punk movement, as it emerged in the late 70s and then into the 80s, was very closely aligned to a modern occult movement known as chaos magic. And chaos magic is basically, it's a revolution in the occult. The occult has had you know, particular style of tradition that survived these many centuries. And it's been essentially very formal over the years. We're expecting you to follow the way things are done, to adhere to particular authorities, to follow prescriptions for how rituals are to be performed, and so on and so forth. Whereas chaos magic comes along and says, scrap all that. We're just going to do what works. We don't care. Replace candles with light bulbs, you know, teleconference rituals. They completely opened it up. And this was a trend that was influenced by a guy named Austin Spare, who was a pupil of Aleister Crowley. And the most important chaos magic order is called the Illuminates of Thanateros, who claim basically to be modern revival of the Illuminati. They're called Thanateros because it's a worship of Thanet, which means death, and Eros, which of course means, no, it's usually translated as love, but what it really means is lust or sex.
I would have guessed it was because they were the occult order that created the band Pantera, but go on.
Close. So Thanateros basically is the worship of love and death, or sex and death. And the members of this order included Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
Who was the, right? No need to explain. And William S. Burroughs, who was really the godfather of the punk movement.
I don't know about him. The only thing I know about punk is that there's a lot of political messages, but not a lot of ability to play instruments or sing.
Yeah, well, it was a really short-lived movement that made a very, very profound impression. But I think beyond that, it didn't really have much significance. So really where it's important, the punk movement emerged out of the No Wave movement out of New York. So people think of punk as being really a British creation, but it was a New York creation. And it was a circle of artists and musicians that were centered around William S. Burroughs in New York. He had an apartment in New York called The Bunker, and which was kind of like a headquarters for this, basically what became a music and heroin scene in New York. So William S. Burroughs is the father of, he and William and Allen Ginsberg were the fathers of the Beat Generation. And the Beat Generation was really what gave birth to the counterculture of the 60s. So he was enormously influential. And so we talked about punk, we talked about chaos magic, and Illuminates of Thanateros. So where the other influence here that joins in is what's called Discordianism. And Discordianism is what's called a parody religion. It's a religion that worships Discordia, the goddess of chaos. And it was founded by a guy named Kerry Thornley, who was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, who supposedly assassinated JFK. So when Jim Garrison reopened the investigation...
Another connection on him, he also had a girlfriend named Mary, who created a cancer virus in a lab, and that cancer virus ended up in a lot of the vaccines.
Right. Yeah, so lots of suspicious things going on. So when Jim Garrison reopened the investigation, one of the people he decided to bring back to trial was Kerry Thornley, because he believed that the Discordian Society was a CIA friend. And one of the incriminating factors was the fact that on the day of the assassination, Thornley was celebrating, and he'd introduced himself to everyone as, "Hi, my name is Kerry Thornley. I orchestrated the assassination of JFK." He thought it was pretty funny. So basically the whole basis of Discordianism is to mock. And they
to
mock
create
everything.
Discord as the...
right. As yeah. The name goes.
Yeah. They're clearly a very creative bunch.
Definitely.
Now, what's the actual point of it? Like, are they just creating Discord for the sake of it, or is there like an end goal to it, like an actual point?
Well, if I can paraphrase, because so Discordianism was also really popularized and developed by Robert Anton Wilson, effectively in collaboration. Jerry Thornley is a very mysterious guy. I mean, very, very strange guy. He came out with this entire conspiracy theory, I think in the 70s, maybe late 80s, after everything that happened. And he said that he was an MK Ultra victim. And so that the whole, he could remember large portions of it, that he was a child of Nazi parents who had been brought to the U.S., that he was an MK Ultra victim, and that his handlers, one of them was E. Howard Hunt, one of the Watergate burglars, who was also suspected of involvement in the JFK assassination. So basically he claims that, you know, he had nothing to do with the whole thing. The whole thing was basically all because of his mind control programming. And then he spent the rest of his life basically living as a kind of a recluse, as a, you know, kind of a semi homeless person, visited once in a while by, you know, some of his fans. But this is a guy who's had an enormous influence on 20th century history, leading right up until transhumanism. So, you know, a very peculiar character. I really don't understand what a motivation would be for a guy like that. I really can't explain.
Well, I can actually elucidate that to a degree, but I've got this quote from him. It's about the cosmic schmuck principle. Have you heard of this?
No.
No? He says it's good, you know. It was good enough for me to make a meme out of it kind of thing. He goes, the cosmic schmuck principle holds that if you don't wake up once a month at least and realize you've recently been acting like a bit of a cosmic schmuck again, then you will probably go on acting like a cosmic schmuck forever. But if you do occasionally recognize your own schmuckiness, you might begin to become a little less schmucky than the general human average at this primitive stage of terrestrial evolution.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to kind of agree with that, right? I mean, it's provocative, which is what it's intended to be, but ultimately it's really truly satanic and subversive. I mean, there's something to be said for, you know, trying to remain humble and checking yourself and making sure you don't take yourself too seriously. But at the same time, basically what these guys are about is taking nothing seriously.
Yeah, I mean, probably why I have a slight bit of affinity to them, but that's not true. I do take things very, very seriously, actually. Serious enough to quit my job that was paying me really well because I had to do the right thing instead of take the money. You know, serious enough to help out a whole bunch of activists and things like that who can't pay you in order to help them get the word out about what it is that they do. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinny Acewood Show. David Livingstone is my guest. ConspiracySchool.com is his website, and we'll be right back after a few minutes on break. Ladies and gentlemen, don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Acewood Show, broadcasting a couple of days a week for your listening pleasure. And thank you very much for continuing to listen into these shows. And I want to remind people as well that it's quite a struggle doing this job, man. I mean, I've got like real expensive equipment that I need to do it, but also need like just cheap food to eat. And that's been a bit of a struggle. I swear. I don't know. What is it? It's the term financial anxiety. A whole lot of problems that are caused to when people mentally, socially, with their relationships and so on and so forth, are simply caused by just not having enough money, right? And Time Magazine, it wasn't Time Magazine. It was The Guardian Weekly, I think. It released a study that says that money does buy happiness, but only about 60 grand, right? Beyond 60 grand, it doesn't really buy you happiness. What does 60 grand buy you? It means you have a place to live that isn't rat infested and moldy and that kind of thing. It means that you don't go hungry. It means you don't get cold generally. And it means you don't have to worry about where you go and how you get there, etc., right? It's that generalized feeling of freedom. Without that level, though, you have a generalized feeling of dread and anxiety about where your next meal is coming from, how you're going to get $250 in the next 3 days to pay your rent, you know, that kind of thing. That is a constant part of modern existence, isn't it? That's why I ask people to go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and start donating regularly, every week, every month, whatever. Just set up those regular automatic payments so that they just keep walking in, whether or not you agree with what's being said on this broadcast, that you simply support freedom of speech in general. That's the whole idea behind it. Speaking of which, David Livingstone is back. Welcome. Now, we're getting really deep into this. Everybody's interested in one particular thing. Me, I'm a narcissist, so naturally I become a talk radio show host and YouTuber and stuff like that so I can put myself out there. But because I know that, I also try to make sure that there are other people on this show all the time that are getting the bulk of the airtime to promote themselves, etc. I believe that this cancels out my evil. and, you know. But for you, writing books and studying the occult, why for you? Is that your thing?
You know what's happening.
In what way?
To understand the world we're living in, to understand the source of where things are coming from. I find, you know, some people ask me, you know, doesn't it get depressing to know these things? Doesn't it get, you know, but I say, no, it's the contrary. Yeah, I mean, in The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, I think, is the perfect analogy, right? I prefer... As stark, if you leave the Matrix, then you end up in this horrible, bleak world where you're constantly on the run from these machines that are after you, you know, barely making an existence. But that's better than the illusion. So, the more I understand what's happening. The more I find it enriching, the more I find my life fulfilling, the more I find my life has meaning.
You're not one of these people who comes and goes from the movement.
So far, no.
I've seen so many of them, and I was thinking about it really intensely today about how many people who came so far and... are now nowhere to be seen, right? It was like two things. They were in it for the wrong reasons. They, like, you know, they wanted to come out and dispense the truth and wanted a big financial payoff. the naivete. Where's all the major money in all the media, bro? It's in advertising. What's advertising? Well, it's lies and propaganda facilitated by the old Edward Bernaysian technique of creating scarcity and making people afraid as though they're not going to get enough out of whatever unless they spend everything that they've got now and to achieve some temporary happiness in exchange for their soul. Okay, that's how it works. It's not that complicated.
Yeah, and what amazes me is, you know, there's cons everywhere, and it's amazing that there are guys savvy enough to see an opportunity in conspiracy culture, and to really very cynically to look at a network of communication opening up. And seeing an opportunity to manipulate it, there seems to be more of that than there is of sincere investigators. But then at the same time, now, the ones who become popular, I don't think it's by accident.
Yeah. You reckon? Well, I don't know. It depends upon the degree of popularity, I think, right? Because, what was it? Organic growth, right? This is how people think about business and that kind of thing. You actually go from one step to the other, to the other, to the other. There are other people, like, for example, the business model of Rush Limbaugh. Buy a hell of a lot of radio airtime and then boom, spill whatever BS you want over there to create a following and then sell advertisers who want that access to that audience, you know? And for me, if you're communicating important information and you're discussing it long form, it's far more effective than being cut up by advertising. And also, it's far easier to accept information, new information, contrary information. If you're not really in a state of fear and panic and fetal position nature about it and reaching for your wallet to make the boogeyman go away.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a... popularity doesn't, you know, automatically exclude anybody from being a legitimate researcher. But what I found in my book, what I wrote about in my book, Black Terror, White Soldiers, what I discovered, the subtitle of that is Islam, Fascism, and the New Age. And I found the enormous influence. First of all, it's a book that is heavily devoted to exploring the influence of synarchism. And synarchism becomes the influence behind 20th century fascism. And I had no idea the extent to which fascism survived beyond World War II and to what extent it basically transformed Western culture through the support of the CIA and then finally the neoconservatives with the Bush administration. But what I also found is basically... you know, the Nazis were hired after World War II through Operation Paperclip, and they went on to form by networking with various fascist and neo-fascist or neo-Nazi organizations. They created what's known as the Nazi International. And this was an international network that served the CIA throughout the world, but it also served the CIA in the United States. So the dialectic that the United States was operating under was that of communism against democracy / capitalism. And to that end, they employed the Nazis, who were almost by nature fanatic anti-communists and had been since the beginning. They re-employed them in the U.S. to build that same kind of virulent anti-communism. So, like a prime example would be the John Birch Society. So what I found is that effectively the CIA cultivated a conspiracy culture in the United States by aligning itself with the far right and the Christian right. And that's led up right up to the Tea Party movement. So this is why you find in the United States, most of the conspiracy culture tends to have the same message. It's always about returning to the Constitution, the Founding Fathers. It's basically neoliberal.
They won't take my guns. I love the irony of being a prepper when you don't know what you're dealing with. How can you prepare for something that you don't that you don't know, right?
Good question.
No. The answer is you can't, all right? Because preppers don't prepare the one thing that you need in a survival situation. It's the one thing that you can't leave behind. It's the one thing you'll never forget that you have, but it might be the one thing you forget to use. It's your head. If your head's in the game, if you're thinking, you'll survive, Okay? The people who die are the ones who stop thinking, start panicking, start running around, and get themselves shot. The people who start shooting early, right? When they don't realize that it's only the scouts, that the main column is much behind them. And when you don't have your claymore mines for them, and you've only taken out the scouts with them, you and your family and every one of them are dead because you didn't think, you didn't check, you didn't pay attention. This is the problem with about 80%, maybe 90% of the conspiracy movement. All right? And I don't think that I'm trying to be conservative, you know, like a successful radio show host should be. But ultimately, what's happening is you've got a fracture now. There's the truth movement and the half-truth movement, and that whole divide and conquer thing comes in again. Right-wing Christian patriot. Okay, name me the networks in the alternative media, in the whatever, you know, that aren't populated almost entirely with that as your program catalogue. Can't name any, can you? Except American Freedom Radio. All right? It's the thing. It's the whole reason I'm on this network, Bo, really. To tell you the truth, and it's not because I don't like Christianity. It's not like I don't like the ideas of libertarianism. It's not like I don't believe in the Constitution. But it's not like I'm going to close myself off to everything except those things, because that's where the dollars are, because that's where the stupid people who will pay me to shill them bullshit are.
Well, you know, the odd thing is that a lot of that whole patriot movement is very Masonically influenced. And I think that there's a degree of anti-establishmentarianism, whatever you want to call it, within Freemasonry. And I think that I'm just guessing, but from what I've seen, because even the John Birch Society was formed of Freemasons, and there are popular conspiracy researchers now who will claim to be Freemasons, and they'll claim sort of like there's good Masons, there's bad Masons, or the Freemasons, or there's a real Illuminati and bad Illuminati. So this somehow seems to be the way it feeds back on itself by supporting the founding of America and reinforcing, which is ultimately a Masonic mission.
The Masonic mission of, like, enlightenment,
the creation of the United
right?
States was a Masonic project.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why George Washington's inauguration ceremony was a Masonic ceremony. He wore a white apron, white gloves, and went on a black and white floor and became the first president of the United States.
That's why they celebrated liberty. Which is,
they wanted to crown him king.
That's why it's a secular state. That's why they separated church and state. It's the first great success of the underground secret society is the creation of the United States. To not understand the United States as being basically the flagship of the occult conspiracy is to completely fail to understand the conspiracy at all.
Well, Freder X has written a book called The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. Okay. I'm trying to look for it in my bookshelf, but I can't quite read it. And he's actually documented this exact split within the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and, like, the rest of Freemasonry. All right? One actually became sort of like a butcher and a slasher, and started to take over the rest of the branches of masonry and corrupt them and turn it into its own thing, or at least the general way of it. And there's a lot of people who do not like that kind of influence, and essentially they believe that a lot of the occult system has been corrupted and it's no longer working and it should be disbanded and restructured, sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that would go to suggest that there's a good portion. There's a good part of Freemasonry. I don't believe there is.
Yeah, I mean, it's like in McDonald's, for example, you'd agree that McDonald's is an evil organization. Now, does that mean that everybody who's Absolutely. Serving you a burger is in league with Satan? No. Yeah. Right, it's that sort of guilt by association thing, and it's the meat grinder essentially. And if you go in and if you don't have what it takes to be a chief scumbaggery piece of shit, then you don't go above a certain level in Freemasonry. It's like, hey, dude, look, you're not good enough to achieve demon possession by some of the dark gods that we worship, okay? So you're just going to have to stay in here. You can maybe sweep the floors on the weekends, and you can make the waffles for the pancake breakfast at the ends of the month for the crippled children, okay? Thank you. Fucking third degrees. Blue Lodge scum. you know, hierarchical structures. What kind of psychological programming really, really digs hierarchical structures and hates creativity and kind of things that go in a non-predictable way? Psychopaths, sociopaths, you know.
Well, that's why the example of the assassins is so important.
Somebody's belief can be really deadly to you. People don't recognize this. Okay, let's say there's a right-wing Christian terrorist, all right, with a bomb strapped to them, okay, and a megaphone in the other hand, and they're threatening everybody to blow themselves up unless all the people around them convert to Jesus. Now, by general consensus, you'd agree that this person's slightly unhinged. I mean, first of all, they've got a megaphone. Second of all, they're Christian. And thirdly, but the most obvious, they've got a bomb strapped to themselves and they're threatening everybody. You know, just the checklist kind of looks out, this person's freaking crazy. But does that mean that because you don't believe their craziness, that they're not dangerous? No. They're extremely dangerous because they really believe it and they really are willing to do bad things to you if you don't do as they say. Okay, it's that kind of awareness of extremism that people in the occult don't have to a large degree. They don't realize how their orders can be used to really frickin' hurt people if they want to. Some of the people that I've been talking to in New Zealand have been stalked by Freemasons for decades, right? Doesn't matter where they move. Doesn't matter if they move to frickin' Gibraltar. After a week working in the kitchens, all of a sudden, these Freemasons start turning up and letting themselves be known. Right? This terrifying international organization based on conspiracy and ritualistic torture and abuse being covered by they're friendly Freemasons. They're just into, like, knowledge and stuff and believing in a higher power, etc. All horrible things in history, all horrible organizations, have had a benign public image.
True enough.
It's the only reason they can get away with it, because you don't suspect.
And the most wishy-washy is a New Age movement.
Let's think about this. The wishy-washy New Age movement, you're aware of Mark Passio, former priest of the Church of Satan. It starts coming out about the New Age movement being all BS and whatnot, designed to sort of corrupt people and give them passive acceptance of evil. Yeah. You'd agree with that. And I asked him what was the origin of this idea of solipsism, you know, that I'm the center of the universe. And why, he didn't know. I don't think anybody knows.
The New Age movement?
No, I mean, I'm talking about solipsism, which is that that perception is reality. Right. This is all a belief, you know. Yeah. That's a very dangerous thing. Could you imagine a world that's controlled by people who don't think there's actually such a thing as reality or truth?
We're living in it.
Oh, my God. It suddenly seems a lot more familiar now, doesn't it? We currently don't. So, David, what you're doing here is like some of the most important sort of laying the groundwork type shit. Because getting the history right is one of the most important aspects of understanding where we are today.
So. My favorite quote is from George Orwell, who said, "He who controls the past, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past."
The history that we learn in schools, as you said, this Western history, as you were talking about that earlier, I came up with Tragedy and Hope.
Quigley.
By, what's his name? Carol Quigley. Right? And how he's praising the setup of this this New World Order and this elite, using all these this fear of a Malthusian catastrophe. Like, oh, everybody's going to turn on each other unless we sterilize half the population and fuck up the entire course of history and destroy empires left, right, and center. You know, we really need to be thankful to these people. They've been really good to us. Sycophants. That's the word, isn't it? Now, I apologize, I've been rambling so forth. So, which is the most important aspect of understanding history, like true history, for you?
Well, you know, when people think of propaganda, they think of, I don't think they realize the extent to which. First of all, they don't understand the extent to which the history of Western civilization is mythology. And then they don't understand to what extent it is underpinning the political maneuverings of our time. So, you know, it's a pretty large story, and it's the fundamental story. It's the history of Western civilization is as I mentioned earlier, it's Hegel's philosophy of history. And Hegel himself, his history was derived from the philosophy of Jacob Burma. Jacob Burma, in turn, he derived his philosophy from Isaac Luria, Rabbi Isaac Luria, who is the founder of the what's called the Lurianic Kabbalah. So basically what they are saying is that humanity is evolving and has always been evolving. So, you know, they show us the history of technology as an analogy, as an example. And then really, of course, the supposed evolution of the human species as an analogy as well, to then suggest that we are evolving intellectually. And what they are saying is that we have been evolving throughout history, and this evolution began in Greece. And what they fail to tell you is the true story of where this evolution actually came from, but they isolated to Greece, Rome, and Europe. So what you're supposed to deduce from that is that this intellectual evolution took place almost entirely and exclusively in the Western world. And the idea of the Western world is a myth as well, too, because there really was no Western world prior to the Crusades. So to suggest that Greece and Rome were part of this quote-unquote Western civilization is crack pottery. But it's the idea is that they want to create this myth of a continuity. And what they're trying to say is that there's been this idea, this burgeoning idea that first developed in Greece, which they call democracy. And it's been evolving slowly over time and perfecting itself. And until our day and age, when we've achieved something or what they claim is is a perfection of this idea, which is basically the Western style democracy, which I find is pretty funny because when you look at American democracy, which is somehow that's supposed to be the fulfillment of thousands of years of evolution. You know, everybody goes to the polls every 4 years to learn to choose from a couple of crackpots. It's not a very sophisticated system.
George Carlin said, what was it? The majority of the population have to elect somebody, and half of the population are dumber than the average person. Did you realize that?
It's a pretty primitive system, I think, finally. But they're trying to sell it now as the pinnacle of history. So this is what Francis Fukuyama calls the end of history. And there's a lot of detail that I follow here in my book. Again, my book on Black Terrier White Soldiers, which shows the evolution of synarchism and where this comes from, because Fukuyama is conservative, and that leads back to Leo Strauss and to Alexander Koyev and so on and so forth. That's more detail we can get into. But basically, of course, it's a reference to Hegel as well by saying the end of history. So it's the idea that we've achieved the end of history. So what they're trying to do is basically is this myth of Western civilization is being used to justify the clash of civilizations, because the new paradigm that we're moving into now is the war on Islam, which is called the war on terror. So this was in the works for a long time. It's designed to replace the Cold War, but it's a new Cold War. So this entire myth of Western civilization has been developed to create the illusion that everything that's of value intellectually in the world has been produced almost entirely in the West. So it's only by being completely ignorant of the achievements of Chinese civilization, of Persian civilization, of Islamic civilization, even Indian civilization, can Westerners be duped into thinking that, yes, democracy is it. It's the only thing that's ever been created of any value. So people are willing to stand by it. And then to then assume that the rest of the world never produced of anything of any value. And so that there are these groups within those cultures that are trying to hold on to their medievalism. And so it's creating an inevitable clash. So that I think is really substantially what the importance of this myth of history is all about.
A clash that they can sell arms to both sides to with money that they loan to both sides to buy.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the means, the bigger picture, of course, is, it's a dialectic. So they're creating both sides. They've created Islamic terrorism, and they've created this illusion of democracy in the West, and both of them are going to be annihilated to be replaced by whatever solution they have in mind.
And it's one after the other, like Russian dolls?
Well, I mean, this is a long-term plan, right? So really, they want to achieve global domination. So I don't think they have a plan of doing this forever. They've got a particular end goal. And I think from what I can perceive of what their long-term strategy is, I believe that the war on Islam is the final stage of what has been basically, at this point, at least 250 years of conspiring.
Right-wing Christian patriots versus Islamic fundamentalists and the rest of the population going from the fallout, you see.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So the fundamental lesson of history is that there isn't actually a fundamental achievement on the part of any particular race or particular country, etc., that the survival and the evolution and the inventiveness of the human race is just that, a possession of the entire human race. Nobody's actually special, but all of us are special.
Fundamentally, yes. I mean, there's a danger here because the paradox really comes down to to the lie that Freemasons are preaching. So Freemasons, like, to give an example, I took my kids to a Masonic lodge had been turned into a museum. So there's a couple of Masons in there, and they are explaining some of the, you know, the little they could about the symbolism. So what they said was, and this is basically the entire premise of Freemasonry, is that everyone's sort of going to their own religion, and that's what's dividing the world. And Freemasons are proposing that we can all get together, that we all need to sort of, you know, let up a little and unite together as a single universal brotherhood, is the way they call it. But that's as wishy-washy, and this is where it gets wishy-washy, because that's what the New Age is all about as well, too. The reason it's wishy-washy is because the truth is that's true fascism. To require the entire world to follow a single ideology in order to supposedly get rid of disunity, that's fascism. The answer is for people to learn to agree to disagree. And this gets back to the solipsism that you're referring to, because basically the New Age teaches that everything is relative. And it teaches that anybody who believes in any particular truth firmly is a fanatic. And that fanatic is going to try to annihilate everybody who disagrees with them. But that's a fallacy. This goes against the entire basis of what that understanding means. It means that I affirm what I believe is the truth, but that doesn't mean that I then grant myself the right to impose that truth on you. That truth means that I have the responsibility now to exercise respect that you have arrived at a different truth. But that tolerance and respect doesn't induce me to question my certainty of the truth. And these examples have existed in the past before. There have been several examples of societies that have established fair multicultural. You see, this is the lie about the United States. And this is the lie that they've only been able to fabricate by omitting the history of other civilizations. So the way that American secularism has justified itself is by claiming that if you grant authority to a particular ideology, it will eventually persecute others. And they'll blame the Christian church, the Inquisitions, and so on and so forth. Say, there you go, there's an example. If you give power to one belief, then they will persecute the other. So the only answer is to remove ideology from the state, which is a lie. So if you look at other examples, primarily you can look at the example of Moorish culture in Spain, Islamic civilization, there's a Persian civilization. Like when Cyrus established his rule over the Persian Empire, one of the first things he did was allow the various religions of the empire to operate on their own, which is the primary reason why the Jews were allowed to leave Babylon and return to Israel to rebuild the temple. And Islamic civilization is the same thing, is that the religions were allowed to operate their own communities, to operate their own legal systems, penal systems, to live by their own religious rules, even if those rules went against the very fundamental principles of the religion of Islam. That's what true tolerance is. And that's the lie, or that's the truth that has been basically omitted to create the history of Western civilization, which is ultimately designed to justify secularism.
Well, it's interesting, because if you get off a plane in any number of the countries in the world today, will you find a unique and distinctive different culture greeting you as you come off that plane? No. It's all exactly the same people in some kind of uniform with some form of Masonic fucking checker on it, checking your bags and scanning you with radiation and spermicidal equipment. You know, that kind of thing is becoming sort of, pardon the pun, uniform, isn't it?
Yes, I think. I mean, human rights is really the dangerous method that's being used to enforce basically one world religion.
Bring in a whole lot of human wrongs.
It's being put forth as a, you know, universal values that we all agree on. And you know, you hear Bush, I heard Obama's speech the other day about, I don't know what terrorist act he was commenting on, but that's exactly what he said, right? This goes against the universal principles that we all agree on. Well, you know, according to who, right? What do you mean? Fundamentally, yes, you know, most people disagree with that kind of thing, but the way he's packaging it is to do exactly that, that it's possible for the world to come to agreement on a particular set of principles. And that's really what the UN is designed to advance, and how the Islamic world is being presented as an opposition to. So this is why now the world has to unite the ground, these, you know, the principles embodied by the UN and to combat this regressive faction of fundamentalists.
I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that the quote-unquote Western world is not very appreciative of the Muslim world not allowing usury.
You name it, right? Not allowing usury, basically, you know, dropping the entire concept of charity, the importance of marriage, you know, honesty, patience. The list goes on and on and on. It's a satanic regime, and it's opposed to everything that's godly. So usury is just one of those basic principles.
Well, it's kind of the central one, in a central banking sense of the word. You know, it's kind of like, who are the axis of evil portrayed by the Masonic-controlled media? All the people that don't have private central banks controlled by the black nobility? And the 84 people that control 50% of the world's economy, according to Oxfam? You know, maybe there's a connection here.
Yeah, I mean, banking is a means of capital accumulation, right? But it's money is a means, and but they use vice as well.
It's the best means when you can create it up out of thin air and then buy real shit with it.
I mean, you know, the more vice they spread, the more gullible people are, right? I mean, it kind of all works hand in hand, I think.
It's a package deal, isn't it? Well, you can't be touched by one part of it without being connected to the rest of its body sort of thing, right? You're born into a system, you go into the education, etc. It's a it's a manufacturing plant. That's essentially what's happened, is you get manufactured inside your mother, and then you get put on the production line, and as you go through your life, people, you know, drill and add stuff to you and take stuff off of you and weld stuff back onto you, you know, that kind of thing. And then you come out and you're essentially a robot. Yeah. Of one persuasion or another, you know, are you a spray-painted red robot, or are you a golden with silver trim robot? It doesn't really matter if everybody's a freaking robot. And this is where transhumanism comes in. It was yesterday or the day before. I don't know if you have these things, but I call them a ping. When you have an instinct, just bing, 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 bing. That's important. A word will string to you for some reason, and you ignore it, but it comes up again. And then if you keep ignoring it for long enough, it starts punishing you, like with cancer. And transhumanism has come up a lot lately.
Yeah.
Why has it come up a lot lately? It's because everything I see is connected with transhumanism. Even right now, in this very show, all of these pieces of technology that we're using to augment our normal human communicative capacity is part of the slippery slope towards using this technology not as an ability to augment our natural ability, but to replace them entirely, where our own thoughts will not be our own, that they'll be controlled by machines instead. That kind of thing really, really frightens me, being an android in a world where there is no freedom but what the programming allows for.
Right. Well, you know, the major agenda of the last 60 years now has been what's called cybernetics. And so already way back in the 40s, the goal was, I mean, really it goes back to creating God. And I'm not saying that as an interpretation or an allegory. I'm saying that this is what they consciously are trying to do. So even the neural language, if you look at Norbert Wiener, who along with John von Neumann was one of the two founders of the cybernetics movement, he wrote a book called God and Gollum Inc. And so basically the goal was from that time to create artificial intelligence, to create a thinking machine. So, you know, we're talking about a time that was long before the advance or the advent of a computer nearly powerful enough for them to conceive of something like this, is because that's what the plan was from the beginning. So their goal was to create a thinking machine, and this is out of that came the personal computer and then ultimately the internet. So, you know, I fault really the conspiracy community, because as I said, it's been really largely controlled by the CIA, so it's always focused on the same red herring. So it's always focused on the Federal Reserve, the Bilderberg meetings, Bohemian Grove, and it's completely missed the true agenda of recent times. And that agenda has been to create the personal computer. The internet has been a long-term plan of the CIA. It is the means to achieve the New World Order. It is, in their own language, it is their attempt to create God. Or what they call, you know, when we go back to the idea of Freemasonry and Universal Brotherhood, this is what they create. They believe that humanity, they follow the ideas of Teilhard de Chardin, who was a French Jesuit philosopher. And he put forward the idea of the Omega Point, which was later popularized by Terence McKenna. So the idea is that humanity is a refurbished idea of the theory of evolution, which says that we are evolving to an endpoint where we are going to achieve collective consciousness. And they believe that that collective consciousness will basically exist in the internet, which will then serve as a god, or which is how we will become God.
And those who don't like it will be excommunicated or disconnected from it. Now, in the modern age, not having access to the internet, it's like a major dick punch to your everyday life, essentially.
Yeah.
Imagine it once everything's connected to the internet, even your fridge, etc., when all the smart technology, the human being will become obsolete, because all we will be is essentially an organic interface with the machine, and we will cease to be human. It's kind of like going to be the post-human era. Now, you can see these things are actually starting to take shape. You see, what was it? I went down to Queenstown. It's the adventure tourism capital of New Zealand, right? And as I was going to a cafe to get some Eggs Benedict with one of my old mates who lives down there, see this chick walking across the street with her cell phone in her hand, just completely. There's no motion. There's no motion in the body at all, like as if it's frigidly aligned with the phone, like a radar antenna alignment, right? And she just walking blindly across the fucking street, and this guy and this this postie in a big van is just like slowing down. And this chick doesn't even notice her or anything like that. And as she clears the intersection, he's like with his arms out the window, like
just in
utter disbelief of what he sees, you know. And it's just, mate, we've become programmed, like just boom, like that. If you get everybody's life and make the vast majority of how they even judge the importance of their own life as being a connection to a piece of technology and only then they are a slave to that piece of technology, and they always will be as long as the center of their life's importance revolves around the use of that device.
But it's funny because when you think of how useless people's interaction with the with these devices is, because it's amazing what the internet has provided in a lot of ways, right? I mean, the fact that you and I can communicate, that the kind of research we've been able to conduct, but that's a very, very tiny fraction kind of uses. Because, you know, when you look at statistics of the popular search terms, you know, it's all big breasts, boobies, anal sex, you know, excuse my language, but that's what people are looking for, right? So it's not, or cat videos. Right, so the pinnacle of
so it's either pussy or cats, you know. That you go.
So it's a medium that offers so much, but accomplishes so little. Fundamentally, it's actually really degraded. It's degraded humans and reduced the quality of human interaction.
There's a science fiction element in the Warhammer 40,000 universe that says that when energy and thoughts are generated, they also produce an equal energy in the immaterium. And at a certain point, as soon as enough pain, torture, debauchery, meaninglessness is accumulated, it'll actually manifest as an immaterial form of consciousness that when it gives birth to itself will destroy and leak into the conscious universe. And I'm just thinking about this, right, in terms of how the human brain works. Memories aren't stored in a solid state. Memories are a pulse reaction to something you see or think about. Somebody tells you stories about high school, then you suddenly start remembering and reliving feelings of what happened to you in high school, etc. That's how memory works. It's reminders. Sometimes you don't know yet you remember things until somebody tells you something or shows you something that reminds you that it's there. And this is how we live our lives, I think, to a large degree. We live it asleep, and the things that we do in the material world manifest somewhere else and then come back to haunt us while we're still awake. Maybe I'm wrong.
I thought you were going to end somewhere.
Just taking a stab in the dark.
That manifestation. I mean, it's happening in a sense.
Well, I mean, if I'm right, what is the manifestation then? Can we see it? Can we quantify it? Can we give it a name, a context?
Well, I mean, I guess in a way the computer and the internet are providing a medium for it, but we're still shaping it, I think. It's like it's the culture that we're creating.
Androgynous. Right. It's without shape, it's without form, it's without originality and without creativity. And it's always changing but always staying the same.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's
it's a virus. That's how a virus works, isn't it?
Yeah, we all hold it.
It's always mutating, but it's always staying the same virus, and it comes around next year. Maybe that's what they're trying to turn humanity into like some kind of galactic plague, so that if they're modified by technology and they're able to control their G-protein levels or whatever the fuck and able to live forever and turn off their aging and their cell destruction DNA, etc., they'll be able to travel the galaxy forever in spaceships, etc.
And they're literally turning people into useless blobs.
Yeah. Maybe it's because they want to cull the population, the vast majority of the population. And they figured out that it's a hell of a lot easier to cull creatures that have been domesticated.
Well, I mean, it's still the whole idea is to empty us of morals so that we can be imparted with a fabricated set of ideas to follow and make us manipulable. You know, so once we're just useless
ideas to control us.
Like you just look at the situation in the United States right now. I think it's truly shocking. I think it's surreal. It's not within my sphere of what I envisage envision as possible for the world. You know, it's not within my expected limitations of reality. It's gone beyond that. It's truly strange. I can't understand how things can get this silly.
Have you ever watched a cartoon that you used to watch as a kid and think were really great, but now you watch an episode of as an adult and you think, man, this is really stupid? That's what it is now, isn't it? Mouse.
I was thinking it's like Broomhilda against Shaggy of Scooby-Doo. You know, it's crazy.
Broomhilda-Doo. I wonder. Okay. It's about maturity, right? Once you realize you're an adult, nobody sits you aside when you're 18 and says, all right, you're an adult now, you've got to brush your teeth and you've got to go to bed early and you've got to work up and you've got to take care of yourself and you've got to be responsible and you've got to not be a duck. You know, nobody comes across and tells you that, so you have to kind of like work that self out for yourself, you know, a bit of trial and error along the way. But I think the most part of it, and the greatest trick of the internet, is we're more connected than ever, but we're more isolated than ever.
Yeah.
All right? If we can shed ourselves of a feeling of togetherness, we're so much easier to conquer, we're so much easier to control, and we're so much easier to usher into a new world order if we don't think about, you know, the other people around us and how they have, you know, shall we say, you feel an obligation, not to your fellow man, but just to yourself, that you can't live with yourself unless you fulfill your obligation. That's the kind of thing that they're trying to rob everybody of, because that's the only thing that can destroy them at the end of the day, isn't it? Somebody says, hey, I don't give a fuck what you say. I don't care what's written in that book, brother. I'm finding out my own destiny and I'm going to fulfill it myself, because everybody else who tells me to abdicate my own responsibility and research my own life and do what I feel is right is a false teacher.
You know, I think that everything they've built up over so many years and the enormity of their power is based on a very faulty premise, which is that people are stupid.
People are. Some people are, but only temporarily.
Right?
There's a lot of really. They
nurture and encourage people's stupidity, instead of if they believed in. Look at Herbert Bernays; it's a classic example, right? That's what he fundamentally believed, that people were stupid, and the more he fooled them, the more he would just shake his head and feel he was confirmed in his premise. But that's because he's a manipulator and he's an egotist. But the reality is, if you believe in the power of the individual, then you nurture people instead of exploit them.
Exactly. You inspire them instead of motivate them and tell them to pay you again for some extra motivation next week. David Livingstone has been my very special guest. ConspiracySchool.com is his website. Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.